Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and the chair of this program. It is hard to believe that it has been a decade since the Commonwealth Club's first program on electromagnetic fields and health, organized by Camilla Reese and the National Institute for Science, Law, and Public Policy in March 2008. Thanks to Camilla's initiative, Commonwealth Club audiences have had the opportunity to hear from dozens of experts on topics related to the electromagnetic field public health issue, including scientists and experts from a range of disciplines and seven countries. But while the country is better informed today about wireless radiation risk, the risks have become much greater with more and more wireless devices and infrastructure, and plans for either even greater antenna densification. Today's program, Reinventing Wires, the Future of Landlines and Networks, looks at the trajectory we're on within a wide lens, defining multiple reasons for a more responsible communication future in addition to the health concerns. Please welcome our panel and co-chairs Camilla Reese and Ellen Marks of the California Brain Tumor Association. Ellen chaired and Camilla served with the California Alliance for Safer Technologies' efforts to prevent SB 649, which Governor Brown vetoed in October.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Bill, and welcome to all. Today we're going to give you the highlights of a new policy paper called Reinventing Wires, the Future of Landlines and Networks, authored by Dr. Tim Sheckley, who is a longtime expert in telecommunications technologies. The paper explains how we got to the point where we're at today, where wireless transmission is increasingly dominating much of our communications, driven not by good public policy or thorough analysis of the best options, but by the expansion goals of the wireless industry and the concentrated market power of three of the largest players, the triopoly, AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast, that resulted from failures in the Telecommunications Act of 1996. The direction of telecommunications infrastructure investment in the United States contrasts with steps being taken in many other developed nations, which are introducing high-speed, safe, secure optical fiber to the premises, whereas today here fiber in the United States is being redirected to support wireless networks. And the present approach is overlooking and disregarding the many negative effects of a wireless basis to communications, things that really matter to us, like the speed of internet access, equal access for all, quality of voice communication, reliability, resiliency in extreme weather conditions, value for the money, energy usage and efficiency, safety and cybersecurity, public health, personal privacy, protection of our ecosystem, landline phone access that works when the power goes out, technology that meets real needs, not things like smart toasters and dishwashers, and the integrity of the system as a whole, which has become, as Dr. Sheckley explains in Reinventing Wires, hijacked by commercial motivations and riddled with planned obsolescence and unnecessary future costs for us all. We have recently witnessed increased public awareness about cell phone risks and screen time risks and tech addiction. And encouragingly, there have even been many senior tech executives speaking out about with remorse about their role in that addiction. But the very significant risks from neighborhood antennas and towers that these devices communicate with remain little appreciated and are equally, if not more, important because we cannot opt out or personally limit these exposures when they are blanketing an entire neighborhood. Now is a critical time that the public must understand these risks because of the planned antenna densification coming to communities nationwide. The proliferation of these new so-called small cell but very dangerous antennas outside every few homes will include the use of 4G antennas, but also the coming ultra-high frequency 5G millimeter wave antennas that bring the health risks to an entirely new level. Antenna densification was the subject of a fierce battle last year in California, where legislation enabling the placement of antennas on utility poles, street lamps, street signs, and municipal buildings, essentially forcing local governments to allow these antennas, was passed by your state legislators. This is a flyer from a collaborative effort against it led by my colleague Ellie Marks. The bill was fortunately vetoed by the governor, but note it originally passed despite the opposition of 300 California cities because elected officials were misled about the technical capabilities and the desirability of and even the need for widespread distributed antenna infrastructure and the Internet of Everything. We are seeing the same push to support the wireless industry's commercial interests and in other states today, as well as at the federal level, where dozens of bills in Congress now seek to enable more and more wireless antennas. So the compelling case that you're going to hear today from our panel about the ill-advised communications trajectory and the need for local communities to take back their broadband future applies to the whole country. These are some antennas in Santa Rosa that have started to go up. Like it or not, they're coming to your neighborhood unless we put a stop to it. The message I hope that comes across loud and clear to you today from today's program is that there is a better way. Hardwired options for the most of our communication needs are the most intelligent choice from a wide range of perspectives, not only health. That investing in fiber to the premises would significantly reduce the energy usage and growth in energy use from wireless access networks. That municipal fiber is the best way to obtain to gain citizens control over internet access and phone service options. And states must repeal any legislation on the books presently preventing communities from creating faster, cheaper, equally available, and safer internet access so that people have choice. Finally, new millimeter wave 5G antennas that have stunning amounts of biological effects must not be allowed to proceed. The wireless communications industry is not serving us, and it is each of our responsibility to see that something this ubiquitous in our lives and as important to our society as internet access embodies our values and is locally controlled by representatives of the people. So thank you, welcome, and our next speaker is going to be Duncan Campbell, who is radio host of Living Dialogues from Boulder, Colorado. He's been involved in Boulder's energy municipalization efforts and is an advocate for democratization of the energy economy and for broadband as a basic human right. Welcome, Duncan.
Thank you very much, Camilla, and what a pleasure it is to be back here at the Commonwealth Club, and I was inspired. We were here 4 years ago, I think it was, 3-4 years ago, talking about the smart grid, and now we're talking about a related entity, which I think has really taken even more of the public attention, and that is what the UK and Canada have recently acknowledged is a universal human right of having access to affordable and sufficiently high-speed internet so that people can actually communicate and be active members of their society. And so what I want to do very briefly is to let you know that in your materials here, we have a description of a program that I did with Tim Sheckley here, KGNU Connections. That is my dialogue program. And again, like Tim's paper, he cites Marshall McLuhan saying the medium is the message, actually even more than the content. And my program formed 25 years ago is about collaborative, co-creative dialogue. And this is really the essence of democracy. It's the essence of what Jefferson referred to as governance by informed consent. So not only do we need this independent public access to the internet that Tim Sheckley will be describing in detail, but we also need to be aware of the fact that there is a democracy movement afoot worldwide now in pushback to the authoritarian tendencies and move to the right that we've seen all across the globe, including right here in our own country. And so what we've seen is the movement, say, for the last 40, 50 years, some date it from the Powell Memorandum of 1971, by Lewis Powell to the Chamber of Commerce to switch the dialogue from the kind of activism we saw in the 60s and public participation and policy making to privatization. The Center for Media and Democracy calls this the privatization movement, led by the Koch brothers and instigated by them in the 60s and turboed by the Powell Memorandum and then Citizens United. Frankie Moore-LePay, known to many of you for her book Diet for a Small Planet 48 years ago, is calling it the anti-democracy movement. And now there's a new fundamental democracy movement happening, and what we're going to talk about today is part of that. It's a way to implement the common weal or the common well-being. We're here in the Commonwealth Club, and the Commonwealth Club's motto, as I note, is find the truth and turn it loose in the world. And so the only way to really turbo this democracy movement that is just on the verge here of coming into energetic being is through education on some of the core issues that are going to affect all of us. That's why we're discussing what we're discussing today. And I want to also mention that in doing a little research on this, in terms of the commons that exist for the public good, it's clear that access to the internet now is as important a commons as existed in the 15th century in terms of, you know, common grazing rights. But instead of a tragedy of the commons, I discovered that there is a new concept from a legal scholar, Carol Rose, in 1986, which he calls the comedy of the commons. And the comedy of the commons means, in short, where users of the commons are able to develop mechanisms to use, maintain, and manage the state of the commons. So now that we've seen that the internet is crucial to our Maslow hierarchy of needs, we've also seen that after the Telecommunications Act of 1996, that the space has been occupied by the triopoly that we're going to be talking about, but it is being taken back internationally by what's called a remunicipalization movement. I'm just noting to you that in your materials, you have an article from Yes Magazine talking about a remunicipalization movement in 1,600 cities in 45 countries that have chosen public ownership as opposed to corporate ownership. That's really the key of this whole democracy awakening movement, and Tim Sheckley will now go into very illuminating detail that will release and loose the truth upon the world.
Thank you, Duncan. And Duncan is going to be back at the very end of the program.
Hi, I'm Ellie Marks, and I know many of you only through email, so please introduce yourself to me later, okay, so I know who you are in person. I am introducing Dr. Timothy Sheckley. He's the author of the paper, which is the basis for the forum this evening, Reinventing Wires, the Future of Landlines and Networks. And it's published by the National Institute for Science, Law, and Public Policy. Tim is a communications technology expert, international consultant in computer engineering and standardization, former faculty member of the University of Colorado College of Engineering and Applied Science and senior research fellow, National Institute for Science, Law, and Public Policy. Tim authored the landmark paper, Getting Smarter About the Smart Grid. In Reinventing Wires, the Future of Landlines and Networks, Tim brings his technical expertise to bear on the wireless industry's plans for antenna densification, explaining advanced copper and optical fiber are far superior to wireless in both cost and performance, that hardwiring, including fiber to the home, should be the technology of choice, and that only investment in wired, not wireless, information infrastructure will meet the nation's immediate and long-term needs. It's my pleasure to introduce Tim.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Ellie. I'd like to thank Camilla Reith for organizing all of this, and I'd like to thank the National Institute for Science, Law, and Public Policy for supporting my work. Reinventing Wires is really about a renaissance in optical fiber and cabling. It's also about wireless and the relationship between them. This work represents the paper itself is about 130-page paper that report that was put together over about a 4-year period. 4 years of research, going to meetings, going to technical standards meetings, going to conferences, industry conferences. I'm a participant in the Telecommunications Industries Association. And they sponsor some of my standards work, and also just reading an awful lot of stuff, mostly on the internet on a very inadequate connection. The executive. I'll start with the first sentence of the executive summary. I think it just shows the motivation behind this. The internet has become one of the defining technologies of the modern world. Why has America, its creator, become one of its most impoverished users among all developed nations in terms of the proportion of its people with internet access and the speed and quality of that access? This report seeks to address these questions and propose answers and solutions. It explores the historical forces at play, the emerging technologies, and the public policy choices and opportunities that we are presented with. Personally, what brought it all together over the last 4 years for me was a number of different things that you've probably been aware of. One of which is the poor service available to us as internet users. The poor service, the artificial scarcity, and the expense maintained by a triopoly of large corporations. I'm not okay there. Good. Okay. Well, we're not there yet. We're here. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Sorry about that. The poor service, artificial scarcity, and the expense. Also, a lot in recent times, the hype around 5G wireless, and all the wonders that that's supposed to bring. The hype around the Internet of Things, which is also brought forward by the industry, and most recently the debate over net neutrality, which we thought was settled, and now is not. Again, also a whole series of security and privacy failures, colossal failures, brought about by the industry, the botnets. Even interfering in our elections. Most of these are the result of the dominant power of some large corporations. In particular, I refer to the triopoly that was mentioned earlier, Verizon, Comcast, and AT&T. The triopoly basically, what these corporations have done is hijacked the internet by commercial interests. It's not just these corporations, but the entire business model built that has been constructed around the internet is hijacking it. But the triopoly is I'm going to focus mostly here on the access network. In other words, the last mile, the way you get onto the internet, and that's where the scarcity really hits. And that's how the United States has fallen to such a low level. You want to keep me on time here?
Yes.
Okay. So basically, the main conclusions that I have are outlined here, and I won't go into them all and read them all in detail, but basically there's a... The internet has been hijacked. Is dominated by a triopoly, a corporate triopoly that owns well over 90% of all internet access, and it's both a wired and wireless triopoly that is coordinated and keeping things scarce. And the wireless cell phones are being oversold. And this came about largely because of the failure of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. I went into some detail in this report on that as to how that came about. We deregulated the AT&T system in 1984 timeframe, 1985, and broke up the Bell monopoly. And what we've had today, what we have today in this country, is a reconstitution of that monopoly in spades. In other words, it's even bigger and more powerful than AT&T was, because AT&T was simply telephone service. And what we're talking about here is telephone, internet, and wireless communications, all combined. So the strategy basically of the industry today has been to force the wired service was a regulated service, and largely, and the wireless was unregulated. So the basic fragments of the Bell system then sought to reconstitute themselves and refocus, spinning off wireless as a business and degrading the wired service. And the basic thesis of this report is that the wireless wired services have been disadvantaged by the wireless industry, and where it is not for financial reasons. It's not that it's obviously wireless. I have a cell phone. Everybody here has one, I'm sure. But the thesis here is that it shouldn't be, we shouldn't depend on that as our basic service. That's an add-on. That's an extra. The fundamental access method that should be provided is optical fiber. And there's what I'm advocating here is a movement to a community-based cities, in other words, cities and towns and communities throughout the country need to take their own communications future into their own hands and to create a basic public utility. Where am I? Which slide am I looking at? Ah, there, this one. Okay. That locally owned, controlled, a basic public utility, just like water, like sewer, streets, libraries. It's not something that can be really provided by a competitive market. It's optical fiber. And electricity, I also believe, should be something provided by the community, because especially with the changing nature of electricity. But that's a whole other story. The optical fiber, the new standard I consider as a basic starting point, is 1 gigabit per second upstream and downstream symmetrical service, like we have in Longmont, Colorado is probably the best example. The most well-known example in the country is Chattanooga, Tennessee, that undertook this. The electric power company, it was convenient for the electric power company to wire optical fiber throughout the city as they went ahead and used it to control their electric grid, and then they also added it on for everybody else as well. And along with that came an economic boom, which really quadrupled the economic productivity above the cost of the system within a few years to really create a business, a new business environment for an old Rust Belt city that could really reinvent itself with a new fiber infrastructure. The other benefits of it is that fiber and copper I'm talking about, both of these, people don't realize that the wireless networks that they use can't exist without advanced fiber and copper. That's how the technologies got developed. It's all been very quiet. We haven't heard much about it. We hear a lot about the wireless services, but nobody realizes that underneath that, all those cell sites and all those antennas have to be interconnected with optical fiber, or it wouldn't work. And there's But why don't we have straight access to the fiber first, and then they can hook up the wireless to it if that's something people want. The other benefit of it is that wires are non-proprietary. Wireless networks are really basically proprietary networks. It's a sort of a miracle that they work as well as they do. And if you knew all the things that are going on inside a cell phone and a cellular network, you know that it is it's one of the most complicated things we have. And it these are all put together basically proprietary systems. The hardware and software are proprietary, and the form that you get the data in is different from what you would get over optical fiber to your home computer or something like that. It has to be repackaged so that you can use it conveniently in a portable format. So, but that shouldn't be your basic access mechanism. It's something that's an extra that you can use when you need mobility. And the fiber and copper are actually simpler and cheaper and non-proprietary, and should be the basis of growth for an economic growth for the community. So some of the benefits are of fiber access to the internet are reduced cost and economic growth. I mentioned small businesses, work at home, education. This is why the service has to be symmetrical, up and down, because every client in the system should be a server, the capability of being a server. You should be able to operate a business in your house that can compete with any other business with this kind of service. I say minimum of 1 gigabit per second. Up and down, and the optical fiber systems can provide even more than that if you want to pay for it. But $49 a month is what you pay for a gigabit in Longmont, Colorado, and not much more than that in Chattanooga, and there are a number of other cities that are building these out. And Fort Collins, another neighbor of mine, is just voted $150 million for building out their fiber system essentially identical to what Longmont did. And there's no reason that this can't happen all over the country. And we don't need to wait for the federal government to do this. This is just like building water systems in streets. It's also the basis of a democratic society, I think, as Duncan referred to, and I think you'll comment on that further, is that the communication is a very fundamental element of a democratic society and the ability to do that. And we've seen it abused. The only way around that is to make sure everybody has equal access to it and that it is not so captured by commercial interests. I don't know how to solve all those problems, but I'd like to my report identifies them. There are a lot of lingering issues. We'll be talking more about the health issues, but I'm going to talk about just the dependency on electronic devices as an issue in itself, and the security and privacy issues. Another aspect of this is I like to emphasize is the vulnerability. When I talk about the Internet of Things and the hype around that, that's kind of what I've been working on for 30 or 40 years, but we never called it the Internet of Things. We called it building control systems or home automation systems and things like that. Primarily, I work on that even now, mostly for applications in energy management, energy systems, and integration of advanced distributed solar plus storage systems. That's what I do in Boulder, but when I'm not working on this paper, but the critical element of that is the premises can have a gateway device that allows access to all the devices in the house. This idea of the Internet of Things is where every object in our whole environment is directly connected to the cloud is a fantasy. It can't work that way. And it's being oversold. And if you really drill down, what you find out is that you need to have a gateway and you need to have subnetworks where that can serve as firewalls and reduce the risk to safety, privacy, and security. This approach has been taken in some European countries like the Netherlands and Germany, at least in regard to electric meters and things like that. But it can be applied to everything, and will have to be applied if the markets are going to develop. The motivation behind the Internet of Things and also 5G is largely the industry's desire to sell more chips, sell more software, and collect more data on you to sell to somebody. And that's the motivation behind it. And I'm not saying that's entirely bad. We just have to recognize that and know what the limits of that are and what we need to do to protect ourselves from it. And the idea of the gateway is an important aspect of that that fits perfectly with the fiber strategy. And if you want to have wireless stuff hooked up to it, then you can do that too. Another point I'd like to emphasize again here is the synergy with the electricity grid. The electricity grid is undergoing a dramatic transformation from a 100-year-old or century-old system, 130 years of centralized, capital-intensive generation, transmission, distribution systems to a totally new distributed, renewable-based consumer commodity where everyone can have solar panels, batteries, and inverters and control systems of their own, and the electric power grid can move from a centralized system to one where a community is sharing electricity among itself, among its own members. And that is enabled, that's partly the reason these electric utility, the municipal utilities in Longmont and Fort Collins and in Boulder, if we can get it, are going to be using this fiber technology to coordinate the flow of electricity within the city and enable these distributed technologies to work optimally. So it will be a vital resource. The issue of resilience is an important one, too. Net neutrality, of course, you get fiber. You remove the digital divide if everybody has equal access to fiber, and especially at a reasonable price like $49 a month. You can also get telephone on top of that if you want it, and also television if you want to pay a little more. The idea of local governance of the network is important. These networks need to be installed by the cities and towns, by the people that live there, and governed by them, and not by corporations. There's an inherent conflict of interest between corporations, private corporations, and their profit motive in operating a public utility like especially this kind of vital facility. There are a lot of applications that could ride on this. The smart city is being celebrated, and there's also going to be a lot of hype about that, but basically it boils down to the use of optical fiber networks to control everything from traffic flows to water systems and electric systems in cities in the future. So just to summarize this, what we need to do is avoid the dependency on wireless for our basic network access. It means the idea behind that's being hyped around 5G is that, you won't need anything else. Everybody will just have 5G wireless. 5G is vaporware at this point. It's not real. There is no such thing. It's still in the lab. And the basic motivation behind it needs to be something more than just selling more chips, software, and collecting data. The wireless is not a substitute for wires. It's an ancillary service. Some of the drawbacks are that it's expensive and ephemeral. I'll touch on just a couple of these. You have a copy of this slide, it's probably in your chair. But with the wireless systems, they're so complex and they depend on the manufacturing of smartphones and things like that with a rapidly changing technology. They want to upgrade these things every few years, so you have to buy a new phone. And that's really – that's an incident that is recounted in this paper. It's a meeting that I attended at the University of Colorado with the IEEE, where we had a presentation from one of the key designers of the 5G vision, who basically admitted that we have to sell more. You know, the company will die if you don't buy a new phone. He admitted that to a room full of engineers. So it's an ephemeral, transitory technology that's going to constantly change. So that's fine, but it can't be the basic starting point for our communication. We need to start with optical fibers that are future-proof, and the security is clear. And I didn't even touch on the issue of – there's a whole chapter in here on energy, the amazing amount of energy that the wireless systems suck up compared to wired networks. So finally, I'd like to just say that my number one recommendation in this report is to invest in fiber as a public utility and do it on a local basis. Figure out how to finance it yourself, but do it. And secondly, there's a whole list of things here that you can look at. One, defending net neutrality, really getting rid of the state laws that prohibit it, which were put forth by the industry, and a lot of other things. But the last one is just a restatement of the first one. Assume local responsibility for fast and equal internet access for all members of the community. So,
thank you. Thank you, Tim.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Okay, our next speaker is Dr. Martin Paul, Professor Emeritus, Washington State University. I don't know anybody who reads the EMF science more than Martin Paul, who has read thousands of studies, and he's going to bring us up to date on the science showing biological effects from electromagnetic fields and the special risks from 5G due to the much higher pulsations that it will involve.
Thanks. Thanks very much. Oops. Oh, okay. Oops.
Oh, sorry.
You better hang on. Okay. Thanks very much. I've got 15 minutes, so I don't have time to talk about any data. What I'm going to do, however, you have a website that's on your material that you can access the evidence for, essentially everything I'm going to talk about. So basically what I'm doing is outline what the situation is, and my focus then is on health impacts of wireless radiation. So my talk will focus on, first of all, eight extremely well-documented effects of non-thermal exposures to microwave frequency EMFs. Why each of these eight have such dire implications, and if I had more time, I'd be able to show you why they're even more dire than what I'm going to say. The cellular mechanism by which these are produced, are nonsensical safety guidelines, which are only based on thermal effects, and why they allow us to be exposed to levels that are approximately 7.2 million times too high. What are the main, what are the many implications that these have for 5G rollout? Okay, so those are the, that's basically. I will not be, as I said, presenting any substantive evidence, but you have access to the evidence. Okay, so there are reviews, many reviews that have published, been published on each of the effects that I'm going to list here, okay? One is on lowered fertility, which includes lowered male fertility, lowers female fertility, increased spontaneous abortion, lower sex hormone levels, and lowered libido. There are 14 reviews that cover various aspects of that. And those include both in humans and in animals. There are neurological slash neuropsychiatric effects. Again, 17 reviews. So these are all extensively documented, and I want to emphasize that. There's cellular DNA damage. This includes single and double-strand breaks in the cellular DNA and oxidized bases in the DNA. These can cause mutations in future generations because we know they occur in sperm, in people, and in animals that have been exposed to the EMFs, and also can cause cancer and when they occur in the other cells of our bodies. Apoptosis, often pronounced apoptosis, programmed cell death. Probably the most important things in causing of these is in causing neurodegenerative diseases and also part of the infertility. Oxidative stress, free radical damage. Here we've got 16 reviews. These have roles in almost every chronic disease you can name. Endocrine slash hormonal effects. There are 9 reviews on this, and this includes both the steroid hormones and the non-steroid hormones are impacted by the EMFs. Increased intracellular calcium. There are 13 reviews on this, and there's cancer causation. There are 34 reviews on EMFs causing cancer. I think the industry claims that there's nothing going on here is complete and utter nonsense. Now, I'm going to talk about the first two of those in a little bit more detail, okay? Reproduction. So what do we know about reproduction in addition to the animal studies and the studies that have been done on humans in terms of the direct EMF effects? We also know that human sperm count has dropped by over 50% of what used to be considered normal throughout the technologically advanced countries in the world. Every single one of them, there's been a huge drop in sperm count. We know that reproductive rates in those same countries have fallen below replacement levels in every technologically advanced country in the world, including every EU country, including the U.S. and Canada, including the Eastern Asian countries, and who are considered technologically advanced, including Australia and New Zealand. And the average reproduction levels are about 73% of replacement levels. So in other words, those countries are all looking at major eventual population declines. Now, you can say, well, we got too many people. And maybe we do. But let's look at what happens in animals when you do the same sort of exposures. What's been shown, and this was shown in a beautiful mouse study that was published over 20 years ago now, is that when you expose mice to radio slash microwave frequency EMFs at doses well within our current safety guidelines, there's a immediate drop in reproduction in the first litter that are produced. That level stays at that level for a while, but depending on the dosage, it then drops to essentially zero. And that drop to essentially zero appears to be largely or completely irreversible. So if you stop exposures, you still have no reproduction. So the question is, what happens if every technologically advanced country in the world has no future? Now, we don't know for certain that that's going to happen, but just think about the risks that we are taking. They are unconscionable. There are similar risks with regard to the neurological and neuropsychiatric effects. There are many studies that have shown that there are massive effects of these EMFs on the nervous system, including the brain. And the EMF exposures in humans have been shown to cause the following things. So you have sleep disturbance, insomnia, you got fatigue, tiredness, you got headache, you got depression, depressive symptoms, lack of concentration, attention, cognitive dysfunction, dizziness, vertigo, memory changes, which basically means your memory doesn't work well, restlessness, tension, anxiety, stress, agitation, and then irritability. Well, you know that all of these things are becoming more and more common among people that you know personally who are afflicted by this, and we know that these are caused by the EMFs. And let me just say, these effects are also cumulative, and at least in terms of the impacts on animal brains, irreversible as well. So we're looking at absolutely dire situations here. These are the risks that we're taking, is that these are going to keep getting worse and worse and worse. And we know the effects on animal brains get worse and worse and worse, and they get irreversible. Okay, so let's go on. There have been a whole series of studies that have shown that non-thermal EMF effects can be blocked or greatly lowered by calcium channel blockers. So now we're getting into the issue of mechanism. How does this thing work? And these include microwave frequency EMFs. They include nanosecond EMF pulses, so very short pulses, which are becoming more and more an important part of the EMFs that we're exposed to. It includes intermediate frequency EMFs, includes extremely low frequency EMFs like the exposures we get from our power wiring, and also includes static electrical fields and static magnetic fields. All of those effects can be blocked by these calcium channel blockers, which show that they're all going through VGCs, through the activation of these voltage-gated calcium channels, the VGCCs. Okay, now, we are most concerned about the microwave frequency EMFs because of the extraordinary increases in exposure, which, as you've just heard, there are plans for vast increases in our exposure. Okay, what these studies tell us is that EMFs act via activation of the VGCCs, and what I will show you is that the EMFs act directly on what's called the voltage sensor of the VGCCs to activate them. Okay, so each VGCC has a voltage sensor, which is something that controls the opening of the channel, and which is controlled by the electrical charge across the plasma membrane in the normal physiology, in our normal. You know, the normal way in which our bodies act. And this is a model, which is a sort of a two-dimensional model of what these things look like. And the voltage sensor here are all those plus charges in those orange cylinders there. You see those? Those are the voltage sensors. So they have, that orange cylinder is an alpha helix. It has five positive charges in it. You can see the five plus charges. And basically what the voltage across the membrane and the EMFs do is they pull on those charges. And based on the basic physics of this, one can predict that the forces on those charges are approximately 7.2 million times stronger than the forces on singly charged groups that are in the aqueous parts of the cell, the watery parts of the cell. And so, again, I'm not giving you the evidence for that, but you can see that in the materials that I've provided. And what that says is that not only are these things extraordinarily powerfully affected by it, but because heating is produced predominantly by the forces on singly charged groups in the aqueous parts of the cell, that means these effects are something like 7.2 million times stronger. So we're being exposed to fields that are something like 7.2 million times stronger than we should be. That's an absolutely stunning number, of course. So let's go on. The following observations argue that the EMFs act directly on the voltage sensor to activate the channels, okay? And one is that you not only have four classes of the VGCCs that are activated, but you also get activation of the sodium, potassium, and chloride channels, which also occur in our cells, and also on a plant channel that we think is the TPC channel. Each of these has a voltage sensor in it that's very similar to each other. So the fact that they're all activated, again, argues that the voltage sensor is the thing that is being impacted by the EMFs to activate them. You get a calcium influx following EMF exposure, and that can be almost instantaneous. So that argues for a direct effect. Such calcium influx has been directly measured in animal cells, in plant cells, and in yeast following EMF exposures. There's a very important study that was published by Takia, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, in 2016, that showed that the VGCCs are activated in isolated membranes. So you take isolated plasma membranes and you study them in vitro, a totally cell-free system. And those exposed to microwave frequency EMFs are activated. Okay? So that tells you clearly there's a direct impact on the VGCCs by these things. So this is the way the whole thing works. And so now the question is, why are the VGCCs so important as opposed to the other channels that let in sodium, potassium, and chloride, or let out sodium, potassium, and chloride? And the answer, I think, has to do with the great importance of calcium in our systems. And so, again, I'm not going to discuss this in any detail, but that's probably the reason why the calcium channels are so important here. Now, this is an outline of how the whole system works. So how do you produce effects through this? Okay, and if you look across by the middle, okay, you've got VGCC activation there, producing increases in intracellular calcium. That's what that Ca2 plus I is. That's the calcium in the cells. Okay, and that in turn produces big increases in nitric oxide. I'm going across the top there from left to right. Okay, so you get big increases in nitric oxide, and that big increase in nitric oxide is responsible for a lot of things. If you go across just a little bit below the top, what do you get? You have a nitric oxide signaling pathway that leads to therapeutic effects. There are genuine therapeutic effects of these fields, and that's the way we think it works, okay, is through that mechanism. There are also direct effects of nitric oxide that bind to certain proteins called cytochromes, and those include cytochrome oxidase, the terminal oxidase in the mitochondria where you get energy produced. And so you get less energy metabolism as a consequence of that binding. That's been known for a long time. You also get lowered production of the steroid hormones because they're produced through some other cytochromes known as cytochrome P450s. And you get lowered production of those. So those are some of the effects that go through there. You also get effects increased intracellular calcium increases the level of superoxide. Superoxide, you can see down below the nitric oxide. Those two react with each other to form peroxynitrite, which is a potent oxidant, which breaks down to form reactive free radicals that produce oxidative stress and also produce inflammation through NF-kappa B. All those things are involved in producing pathophysiological effects. Okay, so a lot of the damaging effects go through that. You also get damaging effects through excessive calcium signaling. Okay, so So all of the effects that I talked about before that are extremely well documented can be produced through these mechanisms. I don't have time to talk about them, but they are in this table in that. And so everything in here, including the cancer effects, which are listed down at the bottom, can be produced through this mechanism, okay? So, and including other effects that I'm not going to talk about, really. I'll talk about therapeutic effects, breakdown of the blood-brain barrier, nocturnal melatonin, etc. So there are other things that go on through this. Now, there are important things that influence how big these effects are, and they include the pulsations of these fields. They include the frequency of the EMFs. They include the polarization, and all artificial EMFs are polarized and therefore are more biologically active. They include the fact that different cells respond differently. So if you look at one cell type, the reaction may be quite different than another cell type. They include the fact that there are exposure windows that produce maximum biological effects. And if you go either lower or higher in intensity, they drop way down. So what does that tell you? It tells you that the dose response curve is totally nonlinear and, in fact, is not even monotone. It doesn't even increase with increasing exposure. Always. It can decrease with increasing exposure. So all of these things, one of the things that these mean, particularly the window effects and the pulsation effects, is that, you know, what the industry tells you about is average intensity, averaged over periods of minutes to hours. Average intensity has absolutely no value in estimating biological effects. So when they talk about average intensity, they're just giving you complete and utter nonsense. It has nothing to do with biology. Okay, so some of these effects, I've already mentioned this before. Some of these effects, the effects on the nervous system, the reproductive system, some of the hormone systems, and the DNA of our cells are cumulative and often irreversible. They are cumulative and they're often irreversible. And what in the hell does that do to us then when we're exposed to these things? And when the industry puts out all this propaganda that nothing's happening? I suspect the cardiac effects are similar, but I don't know that for certain. Now, what about 5G? The reason that the industry has decided to go to the extremely high frequencies in 5G is that it's possible to carry much more information via pulsations than it is possible to carry with lower frequencies. And so they want to go to 5G and these very high frequencies, and we can be assured, therefore, that these will be very highly pulsed. And as I've already said, the pulsed EMFs are much more dangerous than the non-pulsed EMFs, and so this should be a red flag. And in addition to that, they're planning to use the phased arrays in this system so that the EMFs will penetrate more, because they don't penetrate well, just basically. In fact, they don't penetrate well even with the phased arrays. Phased arrays involved in an additional type of pulsation. Major pulsation. So we have things that are planned to be involved, lots and lots of pulsations. And I expect that they will be particularly active in activating the VGCCs for that reason, and also because they will be have bigger effects on charges, which is the critical issue here. And so I would expect that they're going to have massive effects on these. Now, the industry claims that 5G won't penetrate far, and that's their rationale for saying this. But they've argued that also for the microwave frequency EMFs, and we know that their predictions are false there. So there's no particular reason to think that they're right here. There was a beautiful study, two beautiful studies that were published by Professor Hessig and his colleagues in Switzerland on cataract formation in calves, in where the mothers were grazing near a cell phone tower in Switzerland, and where they gave birth to many calves that had cataracts in them at birth. Okay, now. So what's obviously true is that here are these developing calves buried very deeply in the body of the mother, where the industry says, oh, nothing can happen. And, you know, it's a complete and utter falsehood. Okay. And in addition to that, the safety guidelines in Switzerland are 100 times more stringent than they are in the U.S. or in most of the rest of Europe. So, you know, what does that tell you? It tells you, obviously, our safety guidelines are totally ludicrous. This is the situation we're in. Now, there is, however, a serious question here, and that is, how can conventional microwave frequencies and 5G act deeply within the body? We do know that the electrical parts of the EMFs tend to be rapidly attenuated as they go into the body. So how do you get How can they be acting? And particularly, how can they be acting to activate the VGCCs, which is an electrical effect? And I think the way it works is the following, that the magnetic parts of the EMFs have been known for decades to be much more penetrating than the electrical parts. And if, when they go into the biological fluids, what do? The magnetic parts will move the ions that are dissolved in our fluids and move them. And when you move many of these ions, what do? You reconstitute an electrical pulsation pattern that's essentially identical to what it started with, except at lower intensity. And when you've got a voltage sensor that's highly sensitive to these things, you can generate things that can have effects that are very deep in the body. And that's exactly what Hesek showed is happening. And I think the same thing's going to happen with 5G. Now, so the question is, are my predictions correct? And the only way to find out is do biological safety testing. The current plan is to put out tens of millions of 5G antennae to irradiate all living organisms anywhere near them without one single biological safety test of genuine 5G with all the pulsations that it will entail. In my view, this is almost the definition of sheer insanity. Thank you very much.
I want to remind everybody that after, is this working? Can you hear me? Yeah. That after the Q&A, we are going to have a reception next door, so don't leave. I have the pleasure of introducing Jim Turner. And Jim is a principal in the Washington, D.C. law firm Swenken & Turner and chairman of the National Institute for Science, Law, and Public Policy. Jim represents businesses as well as individuals and consumer groups in regulatory matters concerning food, drugs, health, environmental, and product safety matters. And he's appeared before every major consumer regulatory agency, including the FDA, EPA, Consumer Product Safety Commission, and the Federal Trade Commission. And we're honored to have him with us tonight.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being here. And talk a little bit about what we call knee slap. When I wrote those words down and saw what the letters made, I said to myself, you can't really have a national research group called knee slap. And then I thought about it. And I thought, well, actually, it's kind of cute, so let's keep it. And one of the things I want to say is that we, working with Camilla, have now about a decade's worth of accumulated knowledge about the EMF question. And one of the ideas of the knee slap approach was to create a place, or at least create information that people can use to decide how they make decisions going forward in their own lives. And we think the ability of people making decisions in their own lives is a key to dealing with any of these kinds of issues that you've been hearing today. Just as an aside, I want to say that the kind of development we've heard about in the EMF world, where we have large concentrated corporate entities creating interventions into the marketplace that lead to inefficiency and bad health, is going on in every one of the areas that we have large concentrated entities working economically. They've designed a model that makes each decision rely on how much money can be created as a result of that decision. It's a kind of a strange shift from the premise underlying a free market capitalist system. That system was built around the premise that if you do something really, really good for the people in general, you'll make a lot of money. The premise that we now operate on is if you've made a lot of money, you must have done something really, really good. And that's a big fundamental shift in the way we think about our social development. And it is alienating large portions of the American public, and I think probably the world public as well. It's alienating them in the following way. we have a big national political debate going on, and approximately almost two-thirds and perhaps close to three-quarters of the public is opting out of that debate in one way or another. If you take the current political situation, we have approximately we have more registered independent voters than either of the two political parties. And if you add the voters, the members of the voting constituency that do not register to vote, the number of independents and those not registered to vote is larger than both political parties combined. So what you have in the political framework is a relatively small minority deciding how to use national resources in the political framework for the rest of us, for everyone. One can watch the Trump administration operate and recognize, if you look at the figures I just described and figure out what the support is, it's roughly something between 27-28% of the population. That's what's known as the base. It's very important to understand that that's almost identical to what Obama had. So you need to recognize that what we have politically is a very narrow framework. When that starts to carry over into, say, let's take an area like health, large groups of the population, and again, we think it's something between 50 and 70%, use non-pharmaceutical radiation and surgery interventions to maintain their health. That is a group that is almost overlaps with the voting group. So what you have is a society where the decision-making mechanisms are disconnected from the actual decisions that are made and the people who are affected by those decisions. This is not a good idea, even for the people who make lots of money out of this, because it's an unstable systematic framework. The likelihood of it being sustainable is pretty close to zero. It can't just keep going like that. What we try to do with the studies like the ones that we're doing here is to identify and hand to people who are concerned about the situation that we're in tools and information that they can use to intervene and actually bring that huge majority of the public that is looking for a different kind of expression, give them the tools for that kind of expression. The political debate that we have going on in this country, if you listen very carefully, is a group of people who say, we do not want the government to suppress our freedoms, and therefore we want the free market to exist. Then there's another group who says, but if you look at the free market, you've got corporate entities suppressing our freedoms. And we're handed a political choice: suppress our freedoms by government or by concentrated economic interests. The actual battle in this country is not a left-right battle, because you have in, let's just take the Democratic and Republican parties for the moment, but in right across that political spectrum, you have another debate going on between order and freedom. And we write about this, NESOP's a part of that, and some other groups in our, we have a place to go and read about this called Transpartisan Voice. And it's right now, it's on themaven.com, and it is generated by the Transpartisan Review. And we argue and lay out information that all across the country, there are things going on which are completely outside the left-right framework. You'll have people on the left and people on the right organizing, some of them on the order side and many of them on the freedom side. And the real battles in this country are between order and freedom. And the question is, how do you integrate them? You can't have just order, you can't have just freedom. In this particular case, what we have is a dominant group of economic interests working hand in glove with government on the federal level and also on the state and local level, as they're dominated there, to create a highly integrated system designed to maximize income for the concentrated economic interests. And what's interesting is that across the world, more so than here, but starting to be here, the freedom wing of the debate, the national debate, which on both the left and the right, is beginning to argue for a dispersed control in local communities over the kinds of resources that underpin our economic communications, you know, our ability to talk, our ability to communicate. Those are the movement that Duncan talked about, which is the re-municipalization movement, is a very important part of both the world history and the United States history. A lot of California was built around the ideas of Hiram Johnson, who was a very important innovator along the lines that we're talking about. The American experiment itself rests upon the notion that everyone who is affected by a decision should have a role in making that decision. And there's a huge amount to draw on to create a real effective intervention in the kind of process that you're hearing here. Duncan's going to talk a little bit more about some of the specifics. But one of the most important things to understand is that the kind of intervention or inclusion of consumers into this process creates an even stronger economic framework than we currently have. It makes more money. You actually have a stronger economic framework grounded in a population that is part of the decision-making than you do by just handing them a bunch of rules that they have to comply with. That's why I'm identifying the fact that there are so many people opting out of the healthcare world, for example, that is the organized economic healthcare world. And they're opting out across the board on all kinds of things. And it's just very, very important to recognize that we are not trading off economic well-being for a bunch of abstract principles. When we talk about grounding the whole notion of internet communications or EMF communications or communications in general in the people, that grounding creates a better economic framework for everyone. We're 17 out of 20 of the industrialized nations in being able to utilize the internet resource. 17 out of 20. We're being left in the shade economically, politically, socially. Our tool that we were crucial in creating as a society has been taken over and used better by other societies. And that's an important thing to understand. So what we're talking about is restoring not only the active rights and the active participation of the public, but restoring the economic strength of the country. You do both of those things simultaneously. It's not trading off one for the other. And what we try to do and what our objective is in NESLAP is to bring information like that available to people who want to pursue this particular line of thought. And we believe extremely strongly that the vast majority of Americans, 70%, really want to go down a route that strengthens their own individual rights and the economic power of the society that we live in for the individuals and the collective that is all together. It's not a big trade-off. These are tools that let everyone participate, rich and poor, smart and not so smart, everybody participate in coming up with how we're going to have a strong society economically and a strong society based on the values that we announced as the fundamental American values. That's what we do here, and I hope it's been helpful to you, and you can get a great deal out of these reports.
Thank you very much, Jim. And we're going to have Duncan Campbell is going to speak for a few minutes at the very end. We'll then have questions and answers. If you have questions, send them up on the cards on your seat. And then we'll have a little reception afterwards where you can speak with the panelists. Come on up, Duncan.
Thank you very much, Camilla. Well, this has been really stunning set of presentations. I think it's called me to think about doing something I really wasn't planning on, but to just quote The Second Coming, the poem by W.B. Yeats written in 1919. And this prophecy is now, as we listen to these presentations, coming true in a very unimagined way. I'll just read it. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction. while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight somewhere in the sands of the desert. A shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. We are in this situation, and it's time that we talk very candidly about it, and that brings me back to the very motto of the Commonwealth Club, which is, send the truth and turn it loose in the world. So we're here to speak truth to each other now and to give ourselves information that as Tim has presented, as Martin has presented, as Jim has presented, it can be very useful for us to actually meet this particular challenge. So in this vein, I want to say that in Colorado, on this very point of the need to activate a democracy movement, this particular issue of how we control access to the common weal, to the common wealth, to the common well-being of access to the internet, I think is really a central opportunity to activate not only the democratic experience, but the result that Jim was just outlining. It is in our best economic as well as our best spiritual and community well-being to actually have public broadband, publicly constructed, publicly owned, publicly managed, and our own public ISP. That model happens to exist 20 minutes north of my house in Longmont, Colorado, where they have been noted to be the number one provider of the fastest and the most affordable internet in the country in the recent PC Magazine from last summer. We have in Fort Collins another example, which is 45 minutes north of my house, where they have just passed a bond issue, or not a bond issue, but authorization to proceed with the bond issue for $150 million in a city of 144,000 people to do exactly that, to construct their own fiber optic network, which creates a commons that cannot be penetrated by these corporations that are bringing us and slouching toward Bethlehem to bring us our own demise, as Martin has actually said. I mean, I'm being very candid here. This is not hyperbole. We're literally, cellularly, and in our communications with each other, why can the falcon not hear the falconer? Why are so many of our young people so disoriented and cannot actually even send out a coherent message into the world, take in information, as it was said, from any source and separate the wheat from the chaff and form an opinion and articulate it coherently and send it into the public discourse? That's not happening in our school system, and it's actually been very much not happening, we've seen, because of the addiction to the cell phone and to the wireless world. So you'll find here, for instance, if you want to be active about this in your own community, this business plan of 60 pages for Fort Collins is just an amazing resource that can be really applied anywhere in the country. The program that Tim Sheckley and I did with the manager of Longmont's Municipal Electricity Association or utility, and it's a high-speed internet, the best in the country, is available in this, in your handout, which is a one-hour-long dialogue, a real trilogue, co-creative, that we did on the 5th of January this year. And so, you know, as far as the remunicipalization movement is concerned, again, we referenced that Yes Magazine article from last July. But what I'm really thinking about is my friend Frankie Moore LePay's new book. I mentioned her earlier, and she's doing it with her friend millennial Adam Eichen, who is 25 years old. Frankie and I are contemporaries, and they're doing this beautiful elder youth ethical dialogue, which was recommended by the psychological historian Eric Erickson back in 1963 as being essential to the thriving and survival of civilization. And I am modeling that now for 25 years in my programs and paying very close attention to it because it's reappearing in our political world for the first time with Bernie Sanders. Since the 60s, that dialogue ended at the end of the 60s because of losing faith in the government and its power with the Vietnam War. And we ended up, when I was at Woodstock, actually saying, don't trust anyone over 30. And that particular link has never been restored until now. And so the opportunity to really use this kind of information, this kind of education we're getting here from Tim and from Martin and from Camilla and from Jim to actually organize the community, that itself, the activation of the community around this issue of public weal, common good, and very doable, is in itself, I think, a tremendous opportunity here. So I will end here with Lincoln at a time of great strife in the country. When he gave his first State of the Union address, what he said was, "The struggle of today is not altogether for today. It is for a vast future also." And so I celebrate that with you today. It's been a great honor and privilege to be in this dialogue, and we look forward to the interactive portion of our presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Duncan. Okay. If you have more cards, send them up. Now, let's see. We need to get the mics up there so they can... Okay, so the first question is, can copper lines deliver high capacity to homes and offices, or will fiber need to be installed to each end user home or building? Tim. Nah, it's okay. Thank you.
Is this on? Yeah, it is.
Hello? Okay.
Yeah.
Quick answer is yes, but keep in mind, Ethernet cabling, the kind you can buy at the hardware store, Cat 5, Cat 6 cabling, can operate at very high speeds for short distances. Can operate even at almost a gigabit. The conventional twisted pair can also deliver a gigabit for a short distance. That means you have to have equipment that will serve that, but it could be done. The ideal thing, of course, is to replace it all with fiber, if it's easy to do, and often it is. But you can still breathe new life into the twisted pair if you if it's appropriate.
Okay, Tim, do local communities have the ability to manage fiber?
Yeah, they like to make it sound like it's rocket science. Actually, the Longmont example, maybe Duncan, you could answer that question. The fiber, it doesn't take any – you can just hire the people that know how to do it, and that's what they did in Longmont. They just – oh, we just hired the engineers to do that. It's just like a big big company, right?
Yeah, we asked Tom Roniotis that specifically, and he said, well, we just do the same thing they do. We go to people that know how to do it, we hire them, and we do it on a no-cost, no-profit model for the public in the public good. That's the huge difference here. Mm-hmm. And what's slouching toward Bethlehem to be born is an unequal society that is actually on the verge within the next number of years, as predicted by Thomas Piketty in his book, Capitalism in the 21st Century, a modern-day to Tocqueville, a friend of America, that we have maybe 10 years. And then the thing like a rubber band is going to snap, and we are looking at imminent collapse. And this is something we can seize the moment and do as communities anywhere in the country. Longmont is a very perfect example, as is Fort Collins in Colorado.
Okay, this question is from Martin Paul. Can you talk about sperm damage and low birth rate connection and also DNA damaged sperm? Is that leading to autism?
Okay, well, so when you look at males, and this has been done both a lot of it has been done in animals, but there are also effects on sperm in humans that have been demonstrated. you get big changes in the structure of the testis. You get a lowered sperm count, and you get lowered sperm quality, and you get a lot of DNA effects in the sperm. Okay, and so those then lead to, those then, of course, are expected to lead to mutations, because we know those kinds of DNA damage do lead to mutations. I'm not sure if that answers the question or not.
Autism.
I think autism. I'm sorry? So a lot of them do, it's a substantial minority at this point. So I think that the DNA damage is important in terms of causing autism, but I also think that the direct effects of the EMFs on the brain have major roles in causing autism. I think the direct effects on the brain are by and large more important than the genetic effects, but I think the genetic effects have a lot of importance as well.
Okay, so this question's for anybody. What do you say to the person on the bus streaming a show who just can't wait for the 5G revolution because it'll make his or her show faster and better quality? What do you do or say to remove their blinders and get them to start learning and caring about their and their kids' future? They just want to watch the game on the way to work. What do you say? How do you get people to care about themselves? And
I don't know that I can answer
harm
that.
Being done to their children. Anyone?
Try.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's something I've been trying to do for almost a decade now. It's very difficult. And there's times that I will approach people and say something, and some listen, and some tell me it's none of my business what they're doing. All we can do is continue to try to educate and advocate and legislate and do, you know, what the CDPH did recently. They released a document with precautions for the public and things like the cell phone right to know and things like that and the education that we did here tonight. We just need to keep doing that, and we can't stop. I mean, I have to admit I'm depressed about the USNTP results the other day. I think they were greatly watered down and not representative of what's really going on. But we can't give up, and we have to keep informing people. So just take every opportunity to do so, and hopefully some people will listen.
Okay, so, well, what one of the key things is that we need to get funding into this field so we can do a better job on the communications in all mediums.
I wanted to add a point.
Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
I think that the tendency to be concerned about the people who are closed should at least be accompanied by the fact that there are many people who are open and don't know. I mean, they want to know. They're sitting out there saying, I'm concerned. What's this all about? What's happening? Mm-hmm. And understand that the way the system is organized right now, the huge inflow of information to individuals is staggering. And here you are, and you get 50 messages in a day about stuff that's going to kill you and end civilization. And the first question is, which one should I worry about first? Now, there are lots of people who are interested and want to do something but don't know what to do. So this is part of the reason we want to get this kind of information circulating, get it out to as many people as we can. Those folks are very likely to dig into something. And there's another group. There's that group in generic, but there's another group of people who are extremely concerned about some issue that's not EMF. And they're concerned about, the whole issue of the addictive drugs that are on the market currently. They're very concerned about, to toss some things out that we work on generally, raw milk. They're very concerned about vaccination. These people are very concerned and really digging into their issue. And then you come and you say, excuse me, but let me tell you about EMF. So you want to think about how to help people get this information in. And maybe if there's some sense that these all have the same framework to them, the whole right to choice community and the whole right to information community can begin to support each other on these issues.
So the question is how. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say that, this is even a bigger challenge than probably many of you think, because it's my view that it's highly probable that the EMFs themselves are physiologically addictive. There is information in the literature that shows that they work synergistically with addictive drugs, including opiates. And I think that it is highly probable, but not dead certain, that they are the major cause of the opiate crisis. That is, it's not actually due primarily to opiates. It's due to the interaction of the EMFs with the opiates. Now, you know, I could be wrong about that, but I really think there's a strong case for those things. Yeah.
Let me jump in quickly and add to that. I've had a long battle ever since 1970 over sweeteners, and in particular NutraSweet. And the thing NutraSweet does is create glioblastomas. I mean, it actually causes them to become more virulent. And when the research what we were relying on was done, they identified the possibility of an interaction between EMF and the NutraSweet, the chemical, on glioblastomas. This was this was like 1976. And one of the most important things about regulating toxic chemicals in the environment is that the first issue raised by Rachel Carson was their interactive nature, how one interacted with another. And that issue was raised in 1962 and has never been addressed in the regulatory process, never. Mm-hmm. Their position is, hey, there's this one and there's this one. We can't figure it out. Let them both go out into the market. That's the regulatory position.
Okay,
I just want to add one thing here that Tim and I have frequently talked about this as an instrument of addiction and talk about electronic opioid crisis just exactly as has been discussed here mm-hmm. by Martin.
So next,
very, very aware of our usage.
Next question, please comment on the dark fiber situation. The Verizon et al. Via tax credits built vast fiber optic networks and have abandoned it for 5G. Do you know what they mean?
That's probably a reference to Fios. Verizon developed the Fios system, which was actually excellent, an excellent product. It was deployed in about 5 states, including Massachusetts and New York. But they decided not to go forward with it because they wanted to focus on putting the resources into 5G and using the fiber for 5G rather than sending it all the way to people's houses for
Let me ask a question. We in Washington, D.C., we have an ongoing vigorous campaign to sign up for Fios. Should we or shouldn't we?
Oh, Fios, if it goes to your house, is great. I mean, that's perfect. of course, I would prefer it be done by the cities and towns, and governed by them, not by Verizon. But it's basically a good system. But
they've abandoned it. Yeah. And they're focusing on the wireless approach.
But they
now
haven't abandoned it in Washington.
Okay, great.
There are places where it's used. There's
an interesting thing that you just made me think about. And that is, I will tell you, I know from having watched some corporations very closely that they will present a different program and advertising in Washington than they will in the rest of the country. because if you went in, if somebody who spends their time in Washington goes out to their home district, let's say, and you say Verizon has abandoned Fios, they'll say, that's just ridiculous. I see it every day advertised in Washington. And I know that companies do research on the members of Congress figuring out what they should put in the Washington, D.C. market in order to influence them.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
So is anyone working to open source how to create municipal, I think they mean fiber, how to sell it, how to get it passed, options for how to build it, recommended technology and suppliers?
Well, yeah, we're trying it. Boulder, Longmont, and Fort Collins. We're handing out the Fort Collins business plan here. That's a great resource. Get a copy of it.
There's a link
also
to
that
it on
dialogue. The dialogue that's there, the hour-long dialogue, is a tremendous primer. You just go to that link, kgnu.org/connections, and in 1 hour we cover the answer to that question.
One other answer is the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, ILSR. .org. They have a branch that deals with electric power, municipal electric power, and they have a branch that deals with distributed broadband, municipal broadband.
So our small rural community has begun to establish a municipal internet system, but AT&T has passed a law stopping us. What can stop AT&T? What state? Can somebody?
What state is that?
That was California.
California. Okay, good.
Of course.
Oh. You have to repeal that law.
So how do you go about repealing that law, Jim?
Education.
Ask Dana. You've got to get out there and work. It's got to go and work.
Local action.
Take the information. My theory, working federally, is that you connect local constituents to the member of Congress, and don't worry about what party they are. Get the local constituents to come in and say, you know what, a half to two-thirds of the people in your community don't participate in this process, and they're there for you to carry forward their ideas. Here's some of those ideas. Start that dialogue going, and it's very interesting what local members, what members will do responding to actual local people who come in and talk to them. And I think it works even more on a state legislature, but I haven't done it that much there. But establish that connection, and ultimately run somebody against them if you don't like them.
There's also ballot initiatives. You can do California. You can do ballot initiatives, right?
So, how does 4G, 5G EMF compare to EMF from other sources like TV, radio, ham, Wi-Fi, first pass, etc.?
I just want to say you can't make that comparison without considering the pulsations. Each number up means you've got huge amounts of pulsations. So I think you're asking the wrong question. The question is, how do they compare biologically? And the answer is nobody is looking. And that's a big issue. And I have to say, with regard to the 2G to 3G transition, and Lloyd can speak to that, that even though 3G has less intensity, it seems to be much, much more dangerous.
Okay, so most people are unaware of the dangers of EMFs. Who is suppressing the information, and why don't people care? Perhaps it's because they are addicted. Do you think there's a role of the addiction in people being in a state of cognitive dissonance and just...
I'm sure there is, but of course the basic reason is because of all the industry propaganda that's been telling people things that are simply not true.
I think it's a combination of addiction and what Martin just said, and it's invisible. And people don't want to think that this thing that they love or their laptop or their whatever is going to hurt them. So we have the industry has a lot of things going for them that we don't. So it's a bigger fight than some of the others, and it's a tough situation. And yes, you talked about the addiction. Henry Lai did a study on that there is an addiction to the radiation. So we also have that going on. So, yeah, I think the addiction plays a big factor in people not wanting to make changes, but hopefully we can change that.
Okay, so Bruce Kushnick, in his seminal book in 2015, The Book of Broken Promises, $400 billion broadband scandal, reports AT&T, Verizon, and CenturyLink charged America $400 billion for a fiber optic future that never delivered. Lots of fiber optic cable was installed but never turned on. How can municipalities claim ownership of these fully depreciated intrastate fiber optic cables?
Good question.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. All I have documented this diversion of resources into to cell phone tower servicing and neglect and decommissioning of copper lines, but I hadn't thought about how it can be recaptured. How those resources
intrastate? They haven't been turned on. They've not been connected. You can claim it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting idea. I can't really.
Okay, can the integration of communications and electricity systems with the muni fiber model lead to the advent of a wise grid, not invasive to either biological systems or personal privacy?
What I didn't catch the first part of that.
Can the integration of communication and electricity systems with the muni fiber model lead to the advent of a wise grid not invasive to either biological systems or personal privacy?
You know, yes, the answer is absolutely yes. That's, and I have a section in my paper devoted to that.
Okay.
A couple of pages on that.
For Jim Turner, how do we alert our representatives of the serious risk of antitrust violations in regard to Chinese-owned companies that can be found in our cell phones, cell towers, and upcoming 5G?
basically, people who are in elective office are in the very same trance as everyone else. How you alert them to something is probably have to trick them. They need to be awakened. Now, I said before, I think constituents can actually have an impact on somebody who's in office by having them look at things differently than they do when they're up there meeting only with lobbyists. My way of learning politics, which I started learning it when I was a kid and have continued to learn up until yesterday, and even some today, is that the political system runs on people or money. The currency of politics is people or money. If you don't have people, you got to have money. And when you see people pouring huge amount of money into something, you know that the people aren't there. So when you go to a legislator and you say, hey, listen, do you realize that two-thirds of the people in your district don't believe in the political system, the health system, the community system? They're just sitting out there waiting, and they're happy to be voters if you give them something to vote for. There is a way that they wake up. We take people up on the hill on a natural healing, and it's fascinating to see what happens. The lobbyist, a longtime lobbyist in Washington since 1959 that helped us design this program, said that in the last two Congresses have been the most unhealthy Congresses. There have been people going in wheelchairs. There have been a couple of strokes. There's been a whole series of health problems, and generally they're very unhealthy. When you go and talk to them, we take our natural healers in and we say, look, we're not trying to bring something to you. We're not trying to take something. They ask you, what's your takeaway? We don't have a takeaway. We have a bring to. We're here to tell you about these people out there in the communities and so forth. And they say, well, that's all very interesting, but I have a question for you. Do you have anything for migraines? We've had dozens of meetings like this, and they all go almost all that way. It's not always migraines. I mean, there are other problems that they have. But they are trapped in the same kind of human structure that everybody else is. In some ways, I think one of the things that you could do is just have a thought problem and just think about these people as victims. Think of them as victims. I mean, they're occupying a terrible, terrible positions that are highly overblown. They don't have much maneuverability. They don't have many personal resources. They're pretty isolated people. And if you recognize that, or at least include that in your thinking, you have a different way of communicating with them. Well, one of our people went up there, and she's an energy healer, and we sent her into her congressman's office, and he was standing there, and he started talking to her. And they went and sat in his office for an hour, and they talked about they lived a mile apart, they shopped in the same shopping center, and they had a whole completely different conversation than when a lobbyist comes in and says, hey, listen, what you ought to do is X, Y, and Z.
It's a good idea. We're running out of time. I've been told we must end this session, and thank you very much to the panel. Program will has been videotaped and will be online in a week or so.
So I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum. We thank Camilla Reese and Ellen Marks for organizing this program, and panel members Duncan Campbell, Timothy Sheckley, Martin Paul, Jim Turner, for their comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating more than 115 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Great program.